All right, everybody. We're back. All right, guys and gals. It is my pleasure, my absolute pleasure, to introduce one of my best friends. We use this word spearheads, and spearheads clear the way. You know, we're on this leading edge of God's ever advancing creation, and for some of us, we're fortunate enough to have a bunch of people around you that are doing the exact same thing. And I know a lot of mad dogs, but this guy is a top shelf mad dog that I love tremendously. He's one of my teachers, and there are no two ways about it. I find myself probably 10-stepping with this individual probably more than anyone else. And I have so much respect for this young man. He is absolutely a warrior in this life and many past lives. And as Scott would say, we have fought some battles together in past lives. And with that, I give you my dear friend, Carl Peterson.
How's everybody doing? I'm Carl, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Carl!
Thank you, Tarek, for asking me to do this. Tarek's one of my dear friends. I don't like doing this kind of stuff. Anyone who knows me, I don't like speaking all that much. But for something like this and the guys that were involved in making it, make it all happen, it's a pretty cool deal, it really is. We've been talking about doing something like this for a long time. I'm also not the best with planning and stuff, so finally someone spearheaded it, you know. And there was a bunch of guys that got together, and the committee members, and they were really the guys that made this all happen, those of you who don't know. But I've been to one of these before. It was in Colorado, and it was a really, really good experience. And like I said, a lot of us have heard the tapes of different ones all over the country. There's been a lot of talk about this for a while, and I've heard it announced every week. Twice a week for the last 6 months. So I did not forget that this was happening. Tarek is very punctual, those of you who don't know him, and that's a good thing. I've been sober since May 19th, 06. You hear a lot of people say that, you know, I had no idea I was going to get sober on that day, and that's my experience. I really had no idea I was going to get sober on that day. I had been trying to get sober and was very unsuccessful and did not have a very good experience with sobriety. And so I saw, I guess in my experience, there was really no really benefit in being sober in my experience, because it was not very fun every time I got sober. You would think it would be, you know, because for a guy like me, you know, the big thing I always heard is that kind of alcohol's the problem, you know. When I would get removed from the problem, you would think that the problem would be gone, and it wouldn't. I would be extremely uncomfortable, you know. And I hated being sober. I really, really did. I hated being sober so much. I was so uncomfortable. What I was left with was just unbearable. You know what I mean? It really was unbearable. I think the only time I even got periods of sobriety at times, I think God would just grace me with days where I would just get by. You know what I mean? But eventually it would get so painful I'd go back out again, you know. Really grateful to speak with Lindsay tonight. That was probably one of the coolest deals for me. Me and Lindsay, we've known each other longer than anybody that I've been sober with, you know. Everyone I've watched, unfortunately, fall at the wayside, and Lindsay's the one person that's still around from when I sobered up, you know. And so that's been a great thing to watch her tonight. And to get to be here with a lot of people that I'm actively involved with, and people like John who come down, you know, a few times a year, and I love seeing him and his friends that he brings. And it's just a really cool deal we got this weekend, you know what I mean? It's a really, really special thing. got my buddy Gino in here from Denver, Colorado, and really excited to see him. I'll tell you a little bit about him in a sec. In our first meeting, I was born in Illinois, Chicago. That's where my family's from. But I quickly moved to Denver, Colorado, and I've lived most of my life in Denver. I discovered drugs when I was young, and I really liked them. I liked drugs and alcohol, you know. I really did. Growing up, you know, it was just we lived. My folks moved from Illinois to basically a farm in northern Colorado, the northern part of Denver, which now is very populated. But then, you know, there was all these farms. I mean, really, that's all it was. And so I didn't really have any friends around, you know. And so I spent a lot of time by myself, you know, kind of wandering around. And looking back on my experience, I think the only thing that really got me through childhood was my imagination. Because I would literally, I would watch a movie and then I would go reenact it as a kid, all by myself, you know. And if I wasn't doing that, I was extremely just discontent. I was super bored. Everything annoyed the shit out of me, you know, from my underwear to my socks to, like, everything annoyed me growing up. And it's funny because I never would have thought back on that, but when you start to kind of look back on those kinds of things, you start to realize how uncomfortable it really was, you know. But like I said, I had movies, and that was really my escape as a kid, you know. And I'm talking, you know, preschool, elementary, you know, early elementary. And I had WrestleMania. I had that too. And that was probably like the greatest thing that ever happened to me, looking back on my experience, was Hulk Hogan, and you know, and it was, and then I found out it was fake, and I never looked back. But when I thought it was real, funny story, I actually went to a WrestleMania event when I was in my mom's stomach. Yeah, yeah. My dad, and all his buddies used to rent a bus, and they would all go together, and I'm sure get wasted and party, and they would rent a bus and they'd go, and he dragged my mom when I was like, she was like 7 months pregnant, and so I got to see my first thing. It's in my blood, you know. It's in my blood, you know. But those things, like I said, really was the only relief I had, you know, looking back, until I found drugs and alcohol, you know. That was, and when I discovered that, that was an amazing thing for sure, you know, as everyone talks about. And it wasn't the first time I hear people talk about that. I remember the first time I drank, I drank too much, and I blacked out, and I remember waking up, and I wasn't like, man, I'm going to do this the rest of my life. You know what I mean? And I don't remember any barn-burning experience. I just, you know, my buddy James at the time, he was quite a bit older, and he was doing it, and I did it, and that was it, you know. I think I was really asleep to the effect that it produced, probably until I got sober, honestly. I don't think I really connected the dots and what an impact that it really had on my life, you know. Or at least until I tried to sober up the first time. Because then all of a sudden it was like, oh, fuck, you know. I need some of that, you know what I mean? But yeah, it was a lot of fun. Did a lot of different drugs like a lot of people. But at the end of the road, you know, they weaned themselves out, and I was left with alcohol and cocaine. And those were the two things that really, really did it for me, you know. That was the relief that I really, really desperately needed, you know, and I found it in those two things, and I really enjoyed it, you know, and I really did. I never would have thought it would have destroyed everything, you know, because like I said, it was a lot of fun. I moved around a lot as a kid, and I hated that, and I had no idea how much I hated that until I started doing inventories and having teachers like Scott that we started to investigate some of that stuff. But I absolutely hated that. My family, they believed in the idea that you are who you hang out with. That was my dad's big thing, you know. So I was a very bad actor long before the drugs. And so I think my dad and my family, their solution to that was, well, it must be the kids that he's hanging out with, we're going to move, right? And so we moved from a part of Denver across the way, you know. And I hated it. I absolutely hated it. I hate meeting people. I hated it so much. The uncomfortability of the new guy, you would think after all the times I had to do it, it would get easier, and it never did. It never got easier for me. I think I held resentment towards my parents for that for as long as I could remember. And I don't even know if I was conscious of it at the time. But I absolutely despise them for doing that, you know, because every time what would happen is I would get this little nook of my friends. And truth is when you're a teenager, your friends really are your world. That's it. You know what I mean? That's all I had. You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden they would pick up and move. And I was so young at the time, it wasn't like I could just hop in my ride and fucking, you know what I mean? It was like I was 12 years old. And I get around on my bike and my skateboard, but, you know, I can't. You know, I don't bike 30 miles to go hang out with my buddies, you know what I mean? And I would be stuck in a new town and a new school always. And I absolutely hated that. And it happened all the way up into my senior year in high school. I just, one place to the next. And you would think they would learn from their experience. Every time I just recreate the same exact situation all over again. But that was their thing, you know? My folks moved to Tucson, Arizona, and I was supposed to go with them, and I didn't go. You know, the impact of that, I had no idea what an impact that had, but it was huge on my mom. Come to find out, my mom literally cried the entire drive. That's 800 miles, you know what I mean? My mom, I was young at the time, so my mom, she wanted her son to live with her. I mean, I wasn't even an adult yet, you know. She really wanted me, but I went on a bender, and I didn't go. I didn't show up to the moving date, you know. I thought about going, you know. and I knew when I was supposed to be there, but I went on a prodigious bender, you know. Unfortunately, my experience, as this thing progressed, less and less people tolerated me, you know, and that's just the truth. And there came a time where no one tolerated me, so I moved to Tucson because my folks would give me a place to live, you know. And that was, looking back on my experience, I moved there and I literally knew not a single person in the state of Arizona, you know. And as much as I didn't want to do that, I really had no other options at the time. I just, you know, I'm a mama's boy, you know. I didn't want to live with my dad. But I did that, and it wasn't too long. I created the exact same thing that I created everywhere else I'd ever lived, and cocaine was very readily available in Arizona as it is anywhere else, you know. And I was on top of the world, you know what I mean? Really looking back on it, I remember I was partying as hard as I ever had, and I was having as fun as I've ever had. There was a lot of people in my life. I was the new guy, and it was cool because no one really knew my antics. You know what I mean? No one really knows what they're dealing with until they get to know you, kind of thing. And it was all great until they got to know you. It was awesome. You know, it really was. Oh, I'm the guy from Denver and Cocaine Carl, and yeah, you know. And it was awesome, you know. It really was. Looking back on my experience, that was the pinnacle of it all. It was. I met a lot of great guys out there, guys that really liked to party. And it was, Tucson's just, if anyone's been there, just a really crazy city, you know. Just a really, really interesting city. But it's funny though, because I swore I was on top of the world. And in a very short period of time, I found myself, I had literally burned every bridge. I had destroyed everything. And absolutely no one wanted me around. And the last straw was my dad walked into my room today and said, basically get the hell out of here. You know, you're not welcomed here anymore. And no one else wanted me around. And so I moved to Denver. I moved to Denver, you know. And I'll never forget it. I remember being so happy to leave because I had really pissed some people off, you know. The craving at the time, and I didn't realize, I had no idea what a craving was, but the craving was getting to the point where I was just doing things that was extremely out of character, you know. And I was taking things that weren't supposed, that weren't mine. And people don't like that, you know. It's just, and I was a deadbeat drunk, you know. I can't work for shit, you know. And so, and no one likes a deadbeat, you know. And especially if you live with a father who's an extremely hardworking man who lives by, you know. You are your word, and you keep your word, and you're a man of your word, and you treat people with respect, and you treat other people's stuff with respect. And I had become the exact opposite of everything my father ever believed in, you know. And so it was impossible for me and him to have a relationship, because I was the polar opposite. And he's not an alcoholic, so he just doesn't get me, you know. He would, I mean, literally, there's time he'd look at me, and you could tell he just wanted to be like, what the fuck's wrong with you, you know? Because he doesn't understand it, you know. He doesn't get, you know, yeah, he was a partier. I mean, he got kicked out of college, and, you know, he was a partier, but he wasn't alky, you know. And so he didn't understand the effect produced for me, you know. Because I would have incidents, and one in particular, where I did, I was... He kicked me out, and I talked him into staying. Please, you know what I mean? And I remember getting my act together, to me, meant quit using cocaine and keep drinking. And I did. I was dead set on getting my act together. I was dead set, and I really didn't go out a whole lot. Because, like I said, this was towards the end. Not a lot of people wanted me around. And I remember... I'm going to do this, and again I just torched it to the ground, and that was when he told me, get the hell out of here, you know, you got to go. And so I did. I moved to Colorado, and I remember thinking, I remember on that plane, I was all excited, I'm going to start over, you know, I'm going to start fresh, and it's going to be great, you know. And there was a guy that I knew who was there, and he's like, I'll pick you up at the airport, and you can stay with me for a little while, blah, blah, blah. And I remember going there, and I remember the very next day, I wasn't even there 24 hours, and I'm walking down the street with my luggage because I got kicked out. And I remember just thinking, what the fuck? Like, what am I going to do? I mean, I hadn't seen anyone in years. I didn't know where, you know, it was just one of those feelings of, I'm fucked, you know, like, fuck. And I showed up at my buddy Tim's house, and I was very fortunate. He let me stay with him, you know, up until he kicked me out. Yeah. You know, the progression of this thing just took a hold, and as much as I wanted to get it together, and that was my whole thing, it was never stop. It was just get it together, just get it together. I think a big thing for me is just get a job, and a big thing for me was make a lot. Just I need to make some money, you know. And I would get these jobs, and I would have every intention of going, up until the point that I didn't go, you know. And it was just, the obsession was so, it was just so bad. I mean, there was times where I would be like on my way to look for a job, right, and then the thought would, well. Get hired. I look for a job. You know what I mean? It was always that. Like, I'd always have these plans. I'd wake up, I'm going to do this, this, and this today. And I wouldn't do anything. You know, I'd just get trapped. And I didn't know, you know, why. I really just thought I was really lazy, you know. And I really thought I was a piece of shit. And I mean, that's just the truth. I had no idea. I mean, I hadn't heard of anything. The only exposure I had was there was this meeting, and I don't even know, looking back, I've seen a lot of AA before since I've been sober, but I've never seen anything like this. And it technically wasn't AA, but we used to, it was at this church. I was trying to get my act together, and my mom was like, you should go check out this. And I was like, no, I'm not. Well, if you want to live here, you're going to check out this. Yeah. All right. this is long before. And I remember going, and literally we'd fill out these packets, and it was just, I mean, like, and the only thing I remember is this crackhead Dale. And crackhead Dale couldn't stay sober, you know. And I don't know, that's all I remember about it, other than we used to fill out these pamphlets, and it was basically like this is what happens when I use, so now I'm not going to use because this is what's happened, you know. And I don't know who stayed sober. I know I didn't, you know. But but I started, you know, you start to try to control this thing by various ways, you know. And I remember I was really trying to get off the cocaine, so I met this guy at that meeting, actually, and he was real big in Oxycontin. I remember, yeah, that's what I need. I need you to mellow out. I need you to mellow out, you know. And, I'm tired of staying up for 4 days. I need to mellow out. I remember doing that and it just didn't do it for me. You know, it's just at the end of the day, the whole nodding out thing, you know. It just didn't do it for me, you know, because I'm not an opiate addict. I mean, really, that's just the truth. If it's there, I would have done it, and I did it, you know, but I always went back to the cocaine and the alcohol, always, you know. And it's hard as hell to drink when you're nodding out, you know what I mean? It's just the truth. But here I am in Denver, Colorado, and I had the opportunity to go to treatment. The only reason I went is because I had nowhere else to live, and that's the truth. I'd been offered before, and I said absolutely not. But this time it was that, or I guess the homeless shelter, and I'm not an idiot. So I chose this, and they gave me a place to stay, and that was my first exposure to the 12 steps. It was a treatment center in Westminster, Colorado. And like a lot of people say, a lot of people come to the fellowship far before they're ready. And that was me. I mean, I remember thinking, this is ridiculous. There is no way that I'm doing this the rest of my life. You know what I mean? There is no way. Even though, like, the alternative was exactly what I've been describing. It was just like, I'll take the other. You know what I mean? Like, there's just no way. So I was just milking it. And I was just, honestly, I was drinking and using every day in treatment, you know. I lived at a halfway house, and I'd just go by myself, and I would drink, you know. And obviously, you meet guys in treatment, sometimes they want to drink or whatever, but we just, yeah, that's just what I did the whole time, literally the entire time. And I remember, it was an interesting situation, because at the end of your treatment, what they do is they bring your family out there, and they want you to talk to them in this meeting. And basically admit all the, basically it's kind of like a somewhat of a ninth step, you know, ninth step. But the problem is no one's done any. So literally, even the ones that want to stay sober, they haven't done anything to stay sober, pretty much. They haven't done any step work, so they're literally sitting across from their family, promising they're not going to do this again, inevitably going to do this again, you know what I mean? If they're at it, you know? And that happened, and I'll never forget it, and this is what this is the illness right here. I sat down, and with tears of sincerity, I apologized to them and all the harm that I had caused them. And the truth was, is I drank the night before, and I drank the night afterwards, you know what I mean? But I promise you, I meant every word of it. I looked them straight in the eyes. I'm so sorry for doing this to you. I'm so sorry. And I meant, like I said, I meant every word of it. But I drank, you know. I had no idea of an illness. I just didn't. It was just this place was pretty much about fellowship, and it would keep me sober for short periods of time, you know, a couple of days, a couple of weeks, a couple of months. But I always eventually would go back, always, you know. One of the things that happened was during my second stint in this place. Because I didn't stay sober the whole time, but soon afterwards something came over me, and I had and it really came out of nowhere, because I was basically living in a halfway house doing what I literally is me and this guy Jonathan Lovato, great guy, and really bad alcoholic. It was me and him and this schizophrenic guy so we lived in this halfway house, and he was kind of the head guy, but he was schizophrenic, and I think he had some kind of sleep disorder. So he would take these pills, and he'd be out for like 12 hours straight. You couldn't take a sledgehammer to his head, you know what I mean? And he wouldn't wake up. So we would literally do whatever we wanted, you know? While this guy, you know, who thinks, you know, who's sober or whatever, who's the head of this halfway house, and little does he know, you know, we're just tearing this place apart when he's asleep, you know what I mean? And so I had no problem with what I was doing. It was probably the best I've been doing in a while. Everything seemed to be great, and you know. And something happened looking back, and I don't know. I just had an event happen one night, and it really wasn't any too different than things I had experienced. But it hit me. I was like, I'm done. I'm so over this shit. You know what I mean? I'm so over this. I'm tired of waking up not knowing where I'm at. I'm so tired of hurting people. I'm tired. I'm just tired, you know? And I quit for a little while. I really did. And looking back on that experience, God graced me with, how I stayed sober. I didn't do anything, you know what I mean? And I didn't stay sober long, but it's the longest I ever had by far. And, but eventually I went back out, you know, and in that short period of time, I started going to school with this automotive. I decided I wanted to work on cars, and so I started going to school there, and got a job. And literally, I created a life for myself, you know. And I remember thinking, I'm so busy, I really don't have time for, even if I was to drink, you know, like, I don't really have time for all that, you know, it's just so busy, you know. And so I drank, you know. I remember that first night I went and got drunk and went to sleep and thinking, well, that wasn't so bad, you know. And the very next day I remember going back to the same trailer park that I always hung out in, and I'm sitting there snorting meth. And a couple months later I had burned everything to the ground all over again, you know. I had destroyed everything. I remember I was sitting there smoking dope out of a light bulb in my apartment, and the lights were off, and everything was gone, you know what I mean? And we had been evicted, but I was just kind of riding it out by myself. and it was, here we are again, you know what I mean? I have lost it all again, you know what I mean? Anyways, one of the things that happened during this time is this treatment center said, basically, it's not really working, Carl. you might want to try AA. And then this woman, bless her heart, sent me over to this place called Primary Purpose Club. And that's the first time I met Gino. And I remember seeing him in the clubhouse, and I really wanted to stay sober this time. I really did. And I'll never forget it. And I had just gotten out of the hospital, and I still had my band on me. And I'm walking up, and he comes out of the clubhouse with five other guys, this guy Mike and some other, just great guys. They're all still sober to this day. And I'm walking up, and he had been seeing me around, you know, and walking up, and all of a sudden they're like, "You're coming with us." And I'm just like, you know what I mean? Just like, I don't talk to anyone when I go to these. I go there, and I, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden I'm like, "Well, where are we going?" And you're like, "Well, we're just going to go to some, you know, we're going to go find a meet, and we're going to go drive around a little bit." Well, what time? And next thing I hear is Gino's, just shut up and get in the car. And it was one of those times that it's just, I was so beaten that I was just like, all right, you know. Because I promise you, if you would have caught me at some of those other times, I would have, fuck off, old man, and walked into me. You know what I mean? But I just did. And that was my first exposure to some guys that were sober in a car, and I'll never forget that. It was just a powerful experience for me at the time, and I didn't stay sober, but Gino ended up sponsoring me for a little while, and he really introduced me to the Big Book for the very first time. I've been around recovery a lot, and he was the first guy that really taught me the importance of it, you know, and the impact that could happen if you'll go through this process. But I just, looking back, experientially, not a lot of it really touched my heart, you know what I mean? It was very much informational, because that's just what I was used to, you know? You just, I don't know, not a whole lot of experience, really grinding, calling him a lot, bitching a lot because my life's a mess, you know what I mean? Just whining a lot, you know? If I would have told you that, you know, 8 years from now, me and him would hanging out, you know what I mean, in Conyers, Georgia, you know, what, you know, but anyways, I walked away from me and him were actually supposed to do a fist step. I got into the fist step, and before I finished it one night, my mind told me to take a drink, and I did, you know, and I didn't see him for a long time after that, so I went back out, and I remember thinking, this AA stuff doesn't work. I'm never going back there. I'm never, you know. But so what I did is I got an apartment by myself in downtown Denver, and I was tired. No one really wanted me around anyway, so I just got my own place. But looking back, I really wanted to, because I was so tired of hurting people, and I was so tired of people telling me, what they agree with and what they don't, what I can and can't do. You know, I just, you know how roommates are. So yeah, I did that, and I loved it, man. It was the best. But at the end of the day, there came a time where it became so lonely. You know what I mean? It was so lonely. And I remember I took a drink on a Friday night, and I came to the following Wednesday, and I was just laying there, and I was so sick and tired, you know. And I remember just thinking about it, and I don't know if it was an epiphany or what, but I just started thinking about all the people that I had hurt, all the people that loved me very much. And I remember at one point, literally a tear went right down my eye as I was sitting against my wall, because I had nothing. I had no bed. I had nothing in that apartment. Everything was gone. I was supposed to get all my stuff out of a house that I was moving out of, and I was supposed to be there on a certain day, and I took a drink, and I didn't make that day, and everything was gone, you know. Every possession I owned was gone, you know. And I just couldn't make it, you know, and I didn't understand why looking back, but that line in the big book, I remember reading it, and it fit more than anything of the, you know, that the craving became paramount to all other interests, and that appointment wasn't met. And I had so many experiences of that. That line sealed the craving for me from that day to this day. I'll never forget it. I remember thinking, that is me. That is me. It's not because I'm lazy. It's not because I'm a piece of shit. You know, it's not because I'm a loser. It's not because I have bad friends. You know what I mean? It's because I have a craving beyond my mental control, you know. And even if I want to go, and even if my mind tells me to go, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go, and I'm going to miss that appointment, you know. And I have a lot of experience with that line. I really do. But anyways, I did. I came to, and I was just so, so sick, you know. And next thing I know is, and a lot of people have heard this story, I came to, and I was standing in the middle of a restaurant using their phone because I had no phone. And I was standing in the middle of the restaurant using their free phone. You know, never heard of a restaurant having a free phone. But this one did. And there I am. And all I remember is asking my sister to come and get me, that I'm going to die. That's all I remember. And for whatever reason, she did. And she was so fed up with me. And it was divine intervention why she came. Because I had asked her, literally the last time I asked her, she told me no. Looking back, I have no idea why she came, because she had done that so many times for me. So many times that she bailed me out. Hey, oh, I promise you I'll pay you back. I promise you I won't do it. You know what I mean? And I had torched her over and over and over again. So why she did that, I have no idea. And I'll never forget it. I remember going to her house. I was so sick. I would lose my appetite, you know, towards the end of my drinking. I wouldn't eat at all. And so I would just be so physically weak for days and days to recover. Just it would take days. It would be hard to walk and things like that. And I never forget going there. And I was sitting on her couch, and I was so weak I couldn't move. And her husband, who just hated me. Hated me. And he's, you know, he just got off work, worked a full day, you know, and then he's cutting the grass, and I'm just sitting there, just pathetic Carl, again, you know. And I remember him thinking just like, Jesus Christ, him again, you know what I mean? And we didn't have a very good relationship at all because of me. It was absolutely nothing he ever did. But I remember just feeling so pathetic, you know, just here I am again, you know. It didn't feel any different than any other time I got sober. I had no idea I was going to stay sober, you know. But I did. I don't know. It was very uncomfortable at first, because I didn't really do anything. I ended up here in Atlanta, Georgia. I didn't know anyone again, you know. I lived with this guy. He's actually dead now. He just died not too long ago of an overdose. Really great guy. He let me stay with him. Luckily for him, I would just hang out with him. I don't know. I didn't know anyone. I would just kind of run with that guy. And he had no desire to stay sober. Looking back, I don't know how I stayed sober, you know. But I really wanted to stay sober this time. Like, you know, and I wanted to before. But I really, really desperately wanted to change. And something happened. I was sober, and it was so painful, you know, and it was. I just started coming apart, you know. Because what would happen for me every time I get sober is there would be that week or two of just recovering, you know what I mean, and just getting back to normal and eating, you know what I mean. And then it would get a little bit better for me. I think it was just the relief, you know what I mean, of not being in so much physical pain that I would start to feel better. And usually what happens, I start getting cocky and I start kind of mocking these sober guys. And that's really what started to happen to me, you know. And here I am sober, and this was probably one of the most pivotal moments in my sobriety, looking back on it, is one of the counselors at this place that I ended up in was... she did not like me. I think she probably cared about me. But her way of showing love to me was by screaming at me. She really was. You piece of shit. You know, looking back, you know, a lot of people would say, Jesus, you know, that's kind of harsh, you know. But I was a smartass who couldn't stay sober, you know what I mean? And she put her bullseye on me, and she took every opportunity to call me out on anything, you know? I'll never forget, I was sitting there, and I remember looking her straight in the eye and gave her that mad dog look, and I just said, you know what, I don't fucking like you. And, she, you know, thinking she looked me dead in the eye, and she's like, that's your shit, deal with it. And I'm like, she ended up not being alcoholic. She's not sober, but looking back, she was the greatest. She literally pulled every ounce of anger, and she, oh my God, I would think about murdering her at night, literally. And I say that because she did. She pushed me to the brink of insanity sober, you know what I mean? And it wasn't her, but she just had this ability to pull all this stuff out of me, so much anger. And she did, and I never forget. I remember I hit a point one night, and I literally thought I'm gonna go get a bottle, and I'm gonna go crawl into the woods, and I hope the spiders kill me. You know what I mean? I hope I just die. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know anything. I had no car, and it's just like, here I am, you know? It's just a horrible, horrible situation looking back, but it was the greatest thing ever, you know? It was around that time that willingness came. It just did. That pain ignited a willingness that I had never had before. I became willing to do anything. And I didn't care what it was. I didn't care if it didn't make sense to me, which was a huge thing. I wouldn't do nothing that didn't make sense to me and that didn't seem like that would do something. I'm going to tell you right now, logically, none of this shit makes sense. It's one of the biggest barriers that I had to get over was this idea that logically working the 12 steps works. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense on paper in my experience. But experientially, it makes perfect sense now, you know. But I did. I became willing to do absolutely anything looking back. And it didn't matter what it was. And I did. I got reconnected with Gino, and we started doing some work. And first, I met this guy Danny, and Danny did some work with me over the phone. And really, it kind of took me through the big book again. And Gino already had, so I really kind of knew what was going to be required on some level. Like, I just knew I needed that, right? And so I started doing that. And I started having a really powerful experience pretty early on. I don't know if it was all that time built up of in and out, that everything just kind of hit me at once. But I really started to have a really powerful experience with the steps and with sponsorship and all that stuff. And since that day to this day, I've really just, you know, I've been doing it ever since. And I really can't explain it why, because I can't tell you how many times I just can't stand this stuff sometimes, you know. And it gets so uncomfortable, it makes you want to scream at times, you know what I mean? But something kind of keeps moving you, and you don't realize it at the time, but God just moves you, and He just moves you along this process. And I think the thing that kind of solidifies all that is this commitment for me, is this commitment to continue to do this work, you know? Whether I like it or not, or whether I, you know, feel like it or not, just to continue to do it, you know? Yeah, I mean, it's been an amazing journey for me, you know. It is, I can say today, whether it's financially, whether it's my career, whether it's my physical health, I'm definitely more involved in all those areas than ever before, you know. There's no doubt about that. The evolution at times feels like it's pretty rapid with some areas, and then other times it's creepily slow, you know. But it is, it's been an amazing journey, you know. My home group, for those that don't know, is the Spearheads group of Cocaine Anonymous. We're a very small group of people that believe in going back through the work over and over. I don't know where some of you are from, but in Atlanta it's not a popular thing. So we're a nice tight knit of people. we started a few years ago. We literally sat in Tarek's basement and we all got together and we wanted to create something new. And so 14 of us created something new, you know, and we literally voted on everything from the, were we going to go AA or CA, were we, what time, what place, where, format, everything. Everything was voted on, you know, and it's been an amazing journey. And it's really, I think it's, in my experience, I think we're at a real good spot right now. I think what happens when you're a new group, you get excited and everyone kind of gets interested and, oh man, that seems like a great idea, go through the steps, you know. But the actual practice of that is a completely different story, you know. So we, at one point, we got a bunch of people, members, and all of a sudden we went from, you know, 15 to 20 members to all of a sudden there was 50, 60 people, you know, and with comes that, comes a lot of personalities and all that politics crap. And luckily we've weaned a lot of the process of evolution has weaned all that stuff out, and we've gotten to a spot where we're a tight-knit group of people who believe in going back through the steps, you know, and we're all on the same page, so we get along, we're fine, and group conscience runs easy, because we're all on the same page, you know, and the people that are there are supposed to be there, you know, and it's been an amazing journey, you know, it really has. I can honestly say, you know, the friendships that you'll get as a result of doing the work are so powerful, they're hard to describe, you know what I mean? When I met Scott 2 years ago, the love of my life came into my room one day and said that I'm out of here, you know? And I became so homicidal and suicidal at the time that I didn't know what to do, you know. And I met Scott, and he was the only person in the AA that understood what I was going through. I knew one other guy, but he didn't have a solution for it. so we just planned on how we were going to kill her, you know. but he had he talked my language, you know. And I never, it was a saving grace for me, because I thought I was so nuts, you know, because people, I remember I had a sponsor at the time, a guy named Dunwoody, and I remember he would look at me like three heads, you know. I thought, I'm a killer. I'm a fucking killer. Or I'm going to kill myself. And he, whoa, I mean, he was good. Like, he would be like, he'd be like, dude, it's just a girl, you know. And he didn't understand me, you know, but Scott did, you know. And that's what I mean by that identification and going through the work with him and evolving with, I mean, that was, what, 6 years ago? I mean, I would have never guessed that our, you know, he would still be my teacher, and we have continued to go through the work over and over and over together. And that's what I mean by that. It's one thing to have a sponsor and you guys chit chat and that's all great. And I have a lot of friends that I chit-chat with, but to actually sit down and go through the work with someone over and over, it's a powerful experience, you know, and you'll get to know not only him, you get to know yourself on a level that you've never known. I can honestly say the most beneficial thing about a really good sponsor is a sponsor that's willing to challenge your belief systems. And I mean really challenge them, you know what I mean? I never had that, you know, until I met him. I had never had someone that was willing to investigate that with me, you know, and really spend the time to discover, why is it that I believe this? Where does that come from? You know, why do you continue to act like that? Why do you continue to think like, you know, where does that shit come from? Let's get down to the root, you know, of where that comes from. And that's been probably the greatest journey of all, really, is the smashing of the belief systems over and over and over. And what you're left with in my experience is conscious contact. The belief systems absolutely stand in the way, cement that. It's just impossible, you know. I had no idea I had a belief system about what a man really is. And that belief system almost killed me. It's almost killed me many times in sobriety. I had no idea I had that. I had no idea that that was literally dictating how I interact with people, how I talk, how I, you know what I mean, how I respond to situations, how I carry myself. I had no idea that that was driving everything, you know what I mean? Women, AA, all of it, you know what I mean? The discovery of that was the greatest thing ever, and it really was, and really getting down to where that stuff comes from. And, so I could get free of it ultimately. I mean, I think that's what this whole deal is about, is freedom, you know, so that we can be free and be free together, you know. And I'm so glad to be around people that do the work, because it's an enjoyable thing sharing it with people. You know what I mean? It really is. I don't know. The career has been great. A lot of things have been great. I don't know if it gets much better than the relationships. You know what I mean? The chit-chatting, the hanging out before the meeting, after the meeting, that connection that we have at our home group and in other meetings that I've been a part of, you know, it doesn't get any better than that. And I'm so grateful that I've been blessed with the opportunity, the teachers that have guided me along this path, you know, and the people that have let me guide them, you know. It's been an amazing journey. So that's all I got. Thanks.
All right, we come back at 9:30, please.